For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex, and welcome back to On Air. Hey, Dan. Good to see you. I feel like it's been a while, you know, because we had that period where we've been on our Asia tour with On Air.
On Air, on tour.
Gallivanting from city to city. Yeah, and then suddenly we're no longer... not even traveling together, but we're so far behind. I am very much on the day behind you right now.
Yes. Well, thank you for staying up, because I know it's literally basically 11 p.m. where you are, and it's the crack of dawn where I am. I just opened my eyes and I'm like on air. Literally, I checked.
I've been sitting patiently thinking, okay, you know, we blocked in this time to record. If he can surprise me with, you know, being 10 minutes early, that would be amazing. And I'm super appreciative that you are. For the record, you are in Asia where it's now morning, and I am back in Montreal in Canada, land of IKEA. We all know the drill here.
Land of IKEA. I love it.
ICAO, International Civil Aviation Organization, not to be confused with IKEA. That's where he's from.
Yeah, exactly. But tell us why you're in Canada, if you can, besides, you know, resisting the invasion, the pending 51st state.
Yeah, well, so I'm actually here as the special envoy for the annexation of Canada, and so to ensure that it is the 51st state, they've deployed me to handle. No. Do you know what I was thinking today? Can you imagine if this video, we watch it in a few months' time, we're like, little did Dan and Alex know that country he was sat in was now the United States. It was that the 51st state. But listen.
Oh my gosh.
Any Canadian you will speak to, all my Canadian friends I have here that I've spoken to, just laugh it off as the most ridiculous thing ever. So I don't think we have to worry about Canada's sovereignty.
Well,
but
once again,
I am here.
Let's just be very clear about the fact that it's crazy we have to say this, on air, we support Canada's sovereignty.
Canada's right to exist.
Yes.
Right. And Greenland and Panama and anywhere else for that matter. Very much in the whole let a country be a country kind of category, yeah. you and I. But yeah, here once again for ICAO-related bits and bobs. And this is the earlier timing of being here in terms of the usual calendar, and it's been heavy snow the last 2 days, which
right.
I just find bizarre for the end of March. You know, typically when I'm here in like April, you start to see some evidence of spring, and I think that will be the case next week or so, but it's still very, very much winter and incredibly challenging to walk anywhere, given that I didn't pack ski boots because I thought, oh, okay, it's the end of March. But yeah, lots of snow.
Wow. I mean, it's funny when anytime I'm reminded where North America actually is compared to Europe in terms of how far north it is, you're surprised because even Montreal is so much further south than anywhere in Scandinavia, for example. I've been spending some time with my mom's best friend, who's a Brit, and she's like, oh, yeah, we have all these beautiful flowers blooming in the UK. And my mom is like, we barely have a single leaf on a tree, let alone any flowers in Sweden. So, yeah, I just think it's surprising that it's like that there at the end of March. you know, in Montreal.
They said to my friends here were saying to me that it's that kind of transition again, that where in these couple of weeks it's either or. You're either seeing real evidence of spring, or it's like, whoa, you thought winter was gone. No. But it's so weird. And I know you and I are used to it with the frequent travel, but really weird considering this is still the same week that we were on the Korea-Singapore trip.
Yeah.
So to go from those climates where Korea was cold, Singapore, it was hot and humid, but nice, not too hot. So that was cool. And then from Singapore to Doha, where in Doha, it was far more pleasant than Singapore at this time of year.
Yeah.
So kind of like 23 and clear skies and really very warm. And then to London, that was also strangely very warm on the first night. And then the second night when I was leaving, it was freezing, only to then arrive here, where the moment I landed, the feels like temperature was minus 18. And I was like,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, so I'm going to have to. So I thought, okay, I get my bag off the belt in Trudeau Airport. And I thought, okay, just so that I don't suddenly face this Arctic blast, let me get my big puffer out of the big case, right? So I go to one side to get the coat out, and there's this officer watching from a distance, and I was quite sure he was watching me. I mean, he was generally observing, but I thought, yeah, he's kind of watching me. No big deal. Anyway,
and you started going,
so I get the coat
why
out.
Are you so obsessed with me?
hold that thought, right? So I take the puffer jacket out and put it on, and then I like wrap the scarf like fully around and like above, yeah. And I'm like completely bundled up like an Eskimo, ready to go for feels like minus 18,
yeah.
Which it did. But before I get outside, and I'm now walking in the customs line to give the declaration to then exit, which I've done a million times, I see, as I walk past the guy who I thought was watching me, I see him lean into his neck microphone and kind of say something. And I thought, oh God, he's radioing through the person that I'm about to, you know, give the paper that checkpoint. And I was right. The moment I approached her, before I even said anything, she was like, sir, screening, like for the secondary screening. I said, okay. So I moved aside, and then I'm in this, oh God, it was awful. Right? I was in this, like, you know, what looks like the detention center, okay, for anyone that's bringing anything awful. And so I'm like, where do I have to go? You know, I'm not familiar. And she was like, down to the end. So I go down to the end, and it's the guy who I had noticed from earlier. And he said to me, hi, sir. Now, here's where I want to say, this is probably such a lovely interaction because it's Canada, right? And elsewhere in the world,
yeah.
Not least just across the border, probably would have been awful, right?
Yeah.
He was like, sir, I want to explain why I stopped you. And I said to him, it's okay, you don't have to. It's your job, right? It's totally fine. He said, no, I want to explain. He was like, you were doing stuff with your bags. And I said, oh, is it because I'm like, is it because I completely wrapped myself up to almost being invisible and blah, blah, blah. He said, no. He said, it's quite simple, really. He said, why are all your bags covered in checked luggage tags of Qatar Airways? He said to me, when the Qatar Airways flight landed 6-7 hours ago. So what are you doing in the arrivals hall, in the baggage hall? And I said,
oh my gosh.
Good question. So I said, a good question. I have just come off of a Qatar flight yesterday to London, and I connected in London to come onwards to Montreal. So that's why all the tags are still on the luggage. He was like, I mean, it's as if he just didn't even slightly consider that. He was like, oh, okay. That makes sense. He was like, right, because I was like, that's a bit strange. I said, no, I totally get that. He said, okay, since I brought you in here, I have to now go through everything. I said, okay, that's fine. And he was so nice. So I brought the big bag on, and he kept apologizing. And I kept saying to him, listen, you really don't need to apologize. Of course, everyone finds it inconvenient, but it is literally your job. I said, and I respect that. So it's totally fine. I'm happy to comply. He was like, no, because, you know, anyone else would be really pissed right now. So I apologize because I told you. And he really kept overdoing it with the apology. And I kept saying to him, I promise you, it's fine. In the end, I'm voluntarily like, search the bags, you know, let me go.
It's because you're so polite. You had to be like, you're right. It's fine.
Yeah, he opened the bag and he was like, he goes, wow, this is it's nicely organized.
Yeah, okay. Guys, Alex's suitcase and his hotel rooms are all immaculate. You walk into his hotel room, everything is hung up, it's been steamed. You walk into my hotel room, it looks like our luggage exploded on every goodness. Surface.
I just peered in from the hallway and I was like, yep, okay, have a nice night. That looks up. Anyway, long story short, he had a brief look and he kept apologizing and I kept saying to him, it's totally fine, and then shook his hand and I was on my way. And all of that was just because I wanted to leave the airport in the puffer jacket ready for the cold, and it triggered this whole thing.
It genuinely added about
25-30 minutes to everything by the time I finished it all.
But should have just done it past customs. Literally one minute later.
So, I thought to myself, next time, you just get the bag off the belt and go through customs and then sort it out after.
Good. So I'm very curious. Guys, obviously we're going to get to the Heathrow shutdown, but you just flew from Heathrow. And also you just flew British Airways on a configuration. Well, first of all, you haven't flown British Airways long haul in a while. And secondly, you haven't flown this British Airways configuration in a while. So please, I need to hear everything. I need to hear about how you've suffered, about how you've dodged a shutdown.
We'll come to the Heathrow bit, obviously, after this, because that was really significant. And it's the main topic that we'll discuss in today's episode. I was affected by the shutdown, but totally fine. You know what I'm like when these things happen? It's like I was more in work mode anyway because I was on the news constantly, and I'll come to that. But in terms of actually being then in the first batch of flights the next day that would go out and expecting it to be absolutely chaotic, I can't tell you, it couldn't have been quieter in Terminal 5. I mean, it was the most calm, serene T5 experience ever. I was from the car door into the gallery's first lounge in less than 2 minutes because I started the timer knowing I was going to report this to you on the podcast. I went straight in. The check-in was maybe 15 seconds, and then about 45 seconds later, I was in the lounge. So that was fine. And then I'm flying BA 787-8. The old Club World to Montreal from London. So how does BA compete on the world stage with this product? I have no idea because, I know they don't, and I know they're slowly rolling out these club suites, which I've flown, and they're good. But Club World in 2025 on a tight 787-8. We discussed this briefly, didn't we, about the seats and everything and about where I would choose to sit. I went for the rear-facing
window seat
in the second cabin. So that was 6 kilo.
Okay.
Super private because of how you're shielded. Crazy private to the point that I am 99% sure it affects your service big time because the crew just forget about your existence. And also there's no easy way for them to come to you. They don't know whether they can't fit between that gap around the seat next to you. So they end up talking over the person who's facing you. It's all really awkward and awful and horrible and
So was there someone facing you in the seat next to you?
Well, I've got a story about that as well. So I boarded. I knew my expectations were absolutely on the floor, but the bit that I wasn't expecting, which I was furious about, is I had so much work to do on this daytime flight. So I was like, okay, great. It didn't even cross my mind that none of BA's 787-8s have Wi-Fi. None. I was like, what? And of course, I did that thing where I boarded the 787 and instantly had no cell signal either.
Yes.
So So I hadn't sent any of my text messages. I haven't emailed the emails I now need to send because I'm going to be out of action for 7.5 hours. And I've got no service. So I kind of... Again, you board, you settle into the seat area. Does anyone come? No. I mean, it's just nothing. You just it's the same experience that I described last time where you get on and it's as if someone has said to you, your seat goes into a lie flat bed, you know, and fend for yourself.
Yeah.
Have fun. Yeah, exactly. So I appreciated the fact that it was super private because of the seat that I had chosen. On the other side, it's awfully exposed. But at the same time, like, blimey, someone offer a drink. Nope. So you're there. Captain came on and she said, we need to wait for passengers. So we're being delayed by 15 minutes. Okay. After 15 minutes, she came on. She said, it's going to be another 15 minutes. Then after those 15 minutes, she said, it's going to be 25 minutes. I'm like, oh, we're now an hour, a bit more, right now, an hour, 10 minutes or so in total. The passenger who we were waiting for, turns out it wasn't passengers, but passenger, boards, and I can hear him saying to the crew, please apologize to her. I'm so sorry, so sorry. Thank you, guys. Apologize to her, blah, blah, blah. And I think by apologize to her, he was referring to the captain, which I later know that he was. And he comes, and of course, where's he sitting? He's sitting on the one that faces me. So we're sitting.
No.
And guys, anyone not familiar with what the old BA Club World business class looks like, type it in now on Google Image, British Airways Club World, you know, 787 or BA Club World Old, and have a look at the yin-yang setup that it is. And so each, they fit on a 777. How many? Eight.
It's 242. Yeah.
And on a
787,
it's seven. Yeah.
That's crazy. Right.
Which is crazy that they cram in. For context, I'm looking around thinking, my God, one seat area on almost every other airline is BA managed to squeeze in two on a 787. It's so tight and tiny. Anyway, so he's sitting in the yang to my yin, right? I'm the yin and is there, whatever it is, right? He's there. And he's the divider was up, the privacy divider already. Am I right in saying that divider used to have to be down for takeoff and landing?
I think it does have to be down still.
No, not anymore. It's changed. It only has to be down for the safety demo.
Ah, okay,
even
nice.
The placard has changed because I remember it going down prior to takeoff and down. Anyway, yes. So the crew full sit down. So before I come to him, eventually after about an hour, someone popped their head around and was like, do you want a drink after takeoff? I'm like, okay, I have a cranberry. Okay, and then they go. You know, they're like, they're nice. I don't have any bad words to say about the crew, but like, it's not even, it doesn't even resemble decent business class service. It's nothing. Yeah. It's the service. It's the nice plain Jane interaction I would have in Costa Coffee. Right? Yeah.
It's because the training is not there. It's not the people. It's the lack of proper training, I think.
Yeah, there's no element of service at all. So then they came to take the meal order. What do you want? So I said, okay, can I have this and this? Okay. And that was it. And then he left. So then they push the barrier down. But again, it's all so clumsy and done in such a kind of boisterous way. So, you know, there is a way to go to the passenger and say, sir, just going to press this button here and lower the divider for the safety demo. No, instead, this divider, right, actually is forced down if you push it down from above. So the crew just lean over and push it down. So now I'm suddenly face to face with this guy. And you don't realize that his face is literally here. He's not there. He's here. And I'm like, it was awkward, of course, because suddenly, you know, I was like, hi. He said, hi.
Yeah.
and then there, it was a safety demo. And then after the safety demo, he said, it can go up. I said, oh, okay. So he pressed
nice
it
and
it went up. Yeah, nice. Hi, bye. Right. And it goes up. So flight, fine, beautifully smooth and appreciative for the captain for the regular updates because of the delay and whatnot. Food, awful. Disgusting service, non-existent. The only time they came into the cabin was to bring the tray, put it, drop it diagonally on the table, didn't even straighten it up, no tablecloth, nothing, dropped it diagonally on the table and said enjoy and walked off and never saw him again. I had to press the call bell to get it removed. Okay, removed. And the food was gross and just tasted absolutely freezing cold to the point that it removed any flavor of anything. Right?
Oh my
the
gosh, and that's dough.
Borderline
and,
frozen.
That's Dough & Co. catering too.
No, it was gross. Yeah, yeah, it was absolutely gross. And then to the point that because I kept thinking this is frozen, I kept thinking, oh, I don't eat that. Like, move along to another another thing on the dish. Okay. So then they collect it quickly and then there's just nothing. You're never asked anything. And I just think, God, people, do not waste your money. If you are, let this be a public service announcement. If you are saving up your hard earned money to, for example, take a trip of a lifetime or a honeymoon or something, or, and you're going to make that splurge for business class because of everything that you've heard, please, God, do your research first. DM us. We will be more than happy to help you out. Do not. I just kept thinking, imagine if someone spent thousands on this. It's awful. You get better service, I think, on a train in Europe than you do on there. So that's that out the way. I wanted another bottle of water because I'd finished the bottle of water they gave you. How long do you think before anyone responded to a call button?
I don't know. I mean,
and they're not doing anything. They're right there in the galley. They're right
sometimes
there in the galley.
They don't respond at all, right?
They were not doing anything. I could, apart from gossiping loudly, right? I could hear loads of conversation and laughter, and they're just there on the other side of the curtain. But I can't get out because the other guy's asleep, so you're trapped in. So I press the call button, and I wait and wait 5-10 minutes. So after 10 minutes, I'm like, okay. I cancel the call button. I press it again, and on the 787, the chime is very much a ding loud that everyone can hear. Nothing, nothing, nothing. 5-10 minutes, cancel it again. We're now approaching the 20-minute mark. Press it again for the third time. Nothing, nothing, nothing. In the end, I happened to see one of them is walking through, and I was like, excuse me, excuse me. And he turned, he was like, hello. I said, can I have a bottle of water, please? He said, yeah, okay, I'll go and find one. Find one. So again, why are you making out? I'm asking you for something. Anyway, you know, fine. Very nice. Thank you very much. Get the water. That was it. The next time I saw the crew was because they said, put your seat up, we're landing. And there's just no element of service whatsoever. It's all bizarre. To go back to my story of the guy. The guy next to me, the reason why he said, please apologize, what I later learned is basically they held the flight for him because he is a British Airways captain that was flying the aircraft we were positioning out to Montreal on back to London. So we had this really interesting, because of the shutdown, the crew that were in Montreal, for whatever reason, and they said they didn't tell him the reason, the crew that were already in Montreal that were stuck there from when Heathrow shut down, they could no longer operate that flight that I was coming in on back to London. So they were coming back as passengers. So there was no one to operate the flight. So he said, so they've called me from home standby and I will be flying this aeroplane, he said to me, back to London. So then I said, hold on, are you going back to London tonight? Because I know that this flight lands at 8 p.m. local time and goes back to London about 9:30. He said, no, they have to wait for me to get sufficient rest. So the flight is being delayed to tomorrow morning, he said, so I can sleep. And then once I've slept, I'll fly everyone back to London, because the crew, just as I had been talking about on broadcast, planes and crew out of place and whatever. So then we spoke about the 787. He said to me, like, this one's getting a bit old. He was like, oh, he said, what do you think of the fact there's no Wi-Fi? And we had a whole chat about the industry and how just BA can't compete, what I was saying, how BA can't compete with with this, you know, product. And I said, and it's narrow. And he was laughing and he said, you know, embrace the fact there's no Wi-Fi, detox, read a book. I'm all for reading a book. I love a good detox, but not when I had planned to work on a daytime flight.
Yeah.
So anyway, we had a good chat and he was a really nice guy. And that was that. That was my flight over to Montreal with BA. But oh God, guys, don't spend your hard-earned money on that. Please do not.
I wish Virgin Atlantic flew to Montreal so you could have flown
Me
with
too.
Them because you would have seen, I mean, I know you've flown them, but it's also been a while and they're such a contrast to BA.
I know.
The staff actually, they have the type of service that you would expect from BA, but on Virgin it's just like more proactive. So they would actually, of course they'll be gossiping in the galley, but they would be more enthusiastic to offer stuff and to care of you, you know?
Yeah. No, it's just that I'm amazed at the lack of any. I'm looking around thinking, how is it that I see these same passengers on a Qatar flight, right? And they're all ordering drinks every 15 minutes and ordering food from them every 15 minutes. But on this flight, apparently nobody's thirsty and nobody's hungry, purely because there's no sign of the crew or any element of service. So it's like, because it's like the passengers, and I said this before about Air Canada, it's like the passengers pick up on the fact that that service element is non-existent, and therefore they just quietly get on with it in their seat. And I'm thinking, this is not how the real airlines do this, not for that price and for what they charge on these premium transatlantic routes. May I just add, 5K one way, 5K. For goodness sake.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Oh no, it's crazy. Insane. But first of all, we have to acknowledge how amazing it is how quickly the operations at Heathrow picked back up. The day after,
it was as if nothing happened.
Yeah, it was like, I mean, let's be honest, a normal day at Heathrow is quite chaotic with cancellations. So
especially
that said,
you know, going into Heathrow at that time of the day, you know, in the middle of the day, it's kind of busy, it's hectic, there's been cancellations.
Yeah, I mean, so with that in mind, I'm not surprised there were maybe fewer people than normal, of course. But when I was looking at the departure board the next day and the arrival board, it was shockingly normal so quickly. And people,
so normal.
Of course, people are fear-mongering, like, yeah, this could have impacts for a week plus. And
the impact will be felt for weeks. But when I say that, I'm talking about for the airline, not for passengers, you know. But let's just recap on what happened in case anyone missed it. So late on Thursday night at around 11:30 p.m. local time, there was a very dramatic fire at a substation that is ultimately part of the electricity grid, the national grid in the UK. There was a very dramatic fire at the substation near to Heathrow Airport. And Heathrow doesn't take all of its power from this substation because it's not a big one, but part of its power comes from this substation. For whatever reason, and the investigation is still ongoing, including looping in the counter-terrorism investigators who are also part of this, they are trying to determine what caused the fireball, how this all started and whatnot. But also why this substation fire basically took out Heathrow in terms of plunging it into blackout. So there's the industry focusing so much on that secure perimeter fence and everything that's happening inside, and yet a small substation down the road has a fire and it completely wipes off Heathrow off of the grid. I mean, in every way, shape and form. And we're not just talking about the terminals not having lighting. No, there was no power across the Heathrow estate, including in maintenance, in catering, in the hangars. I mean, everywhere, right? And so this is about 11:30 at night on Thursday. The situation was obviously so severe, at least they had perceived it to be so severe from early on, that around 1 o'clock in the morning, 1-2 a.m. local time in London, Heathrow declared themselves closed until midnight the following night. Not even the wait and see, you know, we're closed for 10 hours, which would give them until about 11 in the morning. And then we'll see, we know we'll provide an update then. Instead, they just, everything operationally that should have happened at Heathrow that day, they declared would not be happening. So what did that mean? It meant around 680 flight departures were cancelled. 680 flight arrivals were also cancelled. It would affect, by kind of unilaterally declaring the place closed until midnight, and remember Heathrow doesn't fly in the night because of the curfew ban, it would affect around 220,000 passengers. So almost a quarter of a million passengers would be affected. And that's what then happened. So Heathrow did not open. The fire was extinguished at the substation in the morning, but Heathrow was not with power. And then the updates came very few and far between. I mean, there was nothing. So I woke up at 4 o'clock that morning because my phone was going nuts, of course, not least because the networks were trying to get in touch with me that let's get this show on the road in terms of broadcast. But also one of my friends, one of our very close friends, was on her way to Heathrow for her pre-wedding trip with all her friends.
Oh, no.
And so she was like, you know, bless her, she was heartbroken. She just couldn't understand that. What do you mean it's closed for a day?
Yeah,
you know?
Should have flown from Luton.
I said to her, Katia, you went down the classy road, right? I said, I've never seen a hen night, a group of, you know, bachelorette hen party at Terminal 5, but this is very, very much Katia.
Yeah.
And it would all be kind of very, very fun, but prim, but proper and respectful. And so they'd all organized, they were flying BA from Terminal 5. And of course, Terminal 5, along with the rest of the Heathrow estate, goes down. But had she have been in that queue with 20 other hen parties on the Wizz Air flight from Luton, she would have been fine. So yeah. It's just, life's not fair. But bless her, she still ended up having a good weekend. But yeah, so 4 a.m., jumped out of bed and started the broadcast. And I was then back-to-back all day while we waited for updates. And there were none until the afternoon, where they said, there's some power. And Sky News had a helicopter with a live feed over Heathrow, and that you could see the lights being turned on in Terminal 4.
No way.
Yeah, that was the first hint. So like, oh, they've got lights are on.
Yeah. I mean, it's so incredible that they would go out and announce it's closed for an entire day. Obviously, yeah, that makes things a lot easier for them, in the sense that there's no people showing up uncertain, will my flight go ahead or not? And yeah, if there's no electricity in the terminal, it's tough to accommodate passengers and help them out and that kind of thing. So obviously, absolutely, we saw them turning away people before they could even get to the terminals.
Yeah, the roads were blocked. Now, I want to ask you, if you were the CEO of Heathrow Airport, right, and you were coming back from a dinner at 11:30 p.m. on Thursday, and you get told that Heathrow has been plunged into complete darkness because of a substation fire, a ferocious fire that's taken out all of the airport estate. What do you do as you, Dan Goz, the CEO of...
I would head into the office and try to sort things out. Isn't that the obvious thing to do?
Well, apparently not. Not so obvious. Have you heard about this?
No.
So, and I'll quote, this is all over the media. They are furious with Thomas Wildby, the CEO of Heathrow Airport. He hasn't been CEO for very long. He gets informed at midnight when he's leaving a work event on Thursday night that Heathrow has no power and there's been this terrible fire that's still blazing and roaring and everything. And it's just down the road from Heathrow Airport. And all of this, by the way, is very credible reporting from the Sunday Times, perhaps the most respected newspaper in the UK. And Heathrow have had the chance to deny this, and they have not denied this. In media, in government, when the entity doesn't provide a complete denial, typically means it happened, right? That's the understanding. But anyway, this is what happened. So, 11:30 or so, he's informed that this is what's happening. Of course, you think, okay, spring into action. I mean, that's you said exactly what I would do, right? Let's get down there. Let's, you know, roll up our sleeves and what's going on. No. Instead, he had decided that part of the team, led by his deputy, would now start working and figure out what's happening. He would go to bed, and he did. And so
good
he
leadership.
Went home. He went home. He went to bed, leaving the decision to close Europe's busiest airport with Javier Echave, who is the deputy. He's the chief operating officer of the airport. He took that decision at 1:44, just a little before 1:45 in the morning, seemingly not with the CEO, because he'd already been out the picture and declared himself good night and hit the hay from an hour and a half before. Heathrow's tower releases a NOTAM. We've spoken about what a NOTAM is before. It's like a memo to the aviation sector, informing that no aircraft can continue to Heathrow. That triggers aircraft all over the world planning diversions, or perhaps more crucially, U-turning across the Atlantic, U-turning across North America, U-turning here, there, and everywhere. Airline jets that had been flying for 4.5 hours were now going 4.5 hours back to that point of origin because it was specifically said, do not come, right? It's like that. I don't know if you've seen that Kamala Harris.
Exactly.
Do not come, right, from the election campaign. But they'd warned that other diversion airports would fill up quickly, so don't come. Crazy chaos, you know, follows with Amsterdam planning the diversions, Frankfurt, Paris, you know, everywhere. And then, of course, all these aircraft turning back. The CEO's asleep. He had the chance. And then in the morning, the first he was involved was he dialed into an update call at 7:30 in the morning. Incredibly a social hour. And then he arrived at the head office shortly after 9. Meanwhile, the CEO of British Airways, Sean Doyle, and the CEO of Virgin Atlantic, Shai, had worked through the night at their respective headquarters, overseeing the massive operational complexity of the sudden closure of Europe's busiest airport. Meanwhile, the CEO of Europe's busiest airport, on a £3.2 million salary, was asleep. Not because he was asleep from the start, but had taken the decision. In all of this, and I don't need to give endless 2 cents on how could he, blah, 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 I wonder, how was it possible to fall asleep? That's the part that fascinates me the most. How on earth, if you're the CEO, do you get told that your entire airport, Europe's busiest, the busiest two-runway airport in the world, has been plunged into darkness, and you say, oh no, good night. How does your mind switch off from that? I couldn't switch off from it. I'm not the CEO. I was up at 4. So there was only 2 hours it had been closed. I was up at 4. I was on it. I was broadcasting. I was, you know, and I didn't have that level of involvement, not even 1% of it. I don't understand how he fell asleep. Is he able to just switch off?
The board needs to replace him. This is absolutely crazy. You spoke about his salary. He is the leader of Europe's busiest airport, and to not show up is just the worst example of leadership. It's, what is he being paid for? What is he there to do,
right,
if not act in a situation like this? So clearly he's not fit for the job. And this again shows me why I like criticizing Heathrow, because Heathrow is not a very customer-centric organization, and clearly from the top down, it's rotten and there needs to be change. It's an airport.
And he's new. Remember, he's new.
Yeah. I mean, it's an airport with some dilapidated, crumbling facilities, delays for completely avoidable reasons, like broken down jetways, lack of equipment. And clearly, the airport is not willing to invest this stuff. It's just, yeah, it's crazy. And Brits should rightfully be outraged. 220,000 people are impacted, and the CEO is asleep, couldn't care less on his £3.2 million salary.
How does one actually unwind and fall asleep when they know what is going on? Something unprecedented, something that hasn't happened before. This was on scale with the ash cloud back in 2010. You know, this was crazy. And talk about, you know, now become an international laughing stock. So, you know, in media we speak about cut through, you know, when something cuts through. Okay,
yeah,
boy, has this little fact of him going to sleep cut through. Everyone knows about it in the UK. It is on every channel. When I say it's on every channel, in the middle of the day, there is a daytime show hosted by 4 women who sit and discuss mostly things related to sex, marriage, divorce. It's called Loose Women. Okay.
Yeah.
It's like a very, very chilled out version of The View in America. Uh-huh. Okay. Loose Women's hot topic today was, how did he fall asleep? He has to resign. I mean, this is the definition of cut through, right? This is,
yeah,
it's all over the papers. People are staggered And if the gentleman is paid £3.2 million as his salary, can he not put in a few hours the night that all hell is breaking loose at Europe's hub airport, the airport you are the chief executive of? That has got to be one of his the most questionable decisions he would have ever made of his entire career. And I can't understand. Also, doesn't it say a lot that there seemingly wasn't anyone to say to him, like, are you for
you
real?
Have to, yeah, you have yeah. to come. Yeah. You don't have
like,
a choice.
Oh, imagine there wasn't even anyone who maybe didn't work for him, because maybe then it's funny with the levels, but maybe anyone who knew and could say to him, no, you should go in, because if the media find out about this, you're going to be public enemy number one. They're going to be calling for your head. You know,
yeah,
like don't...
maybe his wife or something.
Right. And this is what I was thinking. His family did. Can you imagine that was your father? Right. And you're like, Dad, Heathrow's just announced an unprecedented closure for an entire day, and it's in total blackout, and the fire is blazing, and blah blah blah. And he says, "Okay, son, good night." What you were just on a basic level, I don't know. All very very bizarre. I can't understand it.
Yeah, the optics are just terrible. Not least for the fact that, like, thousands and thousands of Heathrow's passengers will be up all night trying to figure out what to do about their travel plans now, how to get where they need to go for essential reasons. So you're saying that
literally
your customers can be up all night, but you
exactly
need your sleep.
But you need your sleep. And it's and I've heard the other side to this argument. I tried to, you know, be balanced and get the other side, and someone said, well, perhaps he recognized that he needed to be fresh for the morning in order to better handle the situation. Tell that to the firemen. Tell that to all of the staff that were at Heathrow trying to operationally figure out what the hell was going on and how they were going to get this airport back on its feet, doing so in the pitch black because there was no power. Tell that to the passengers who had found themselves arriving to the UK late at night and then seemingly couldn't enter, or had already showed up ready for those morning flights, checking in at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. Tell that to all of the Heathrow team who did bother to recognize that this is a moment of immense, unprecedented crisis. It is not a moment to say, yeah, but I really do need a few hours beauty sleep and then I'll come back and address the crisis. And if everyone beneath him was able to recognize that was the right thing to do, how on earth could he, as the chief executive, not also come to that same conclusion? I don't understand that.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny to think that even in normal circumstances, the e-gates at Heathrow are turned off half the time. Now when the power goes, of course, they're turned off. But it's like, it's such
you
a mess to
you
begin with.
You can't see where they are.
Yeah, no, yeah, that's just absolutely
bizarre.
Outrageous. But it is encouraging to see how operations have improved. Probably not, you know, least because the CEOs of British Airways and Virgin Atlantic were up all night trying to figure out, how do we resolve this as quickly as possible?
And
when things get back
I feel
to normal?
For them. I feel for them completely. And today, yesterday it was announced that the airlines will be suing Heathrow Airport, and they are putting in a hefty claim, because understandably so, this is going to cost airlines multi millions. Okay, probably hundreds of millions. And it wasn't their fault, you know. And also, it's somehow the blame game is shifting, because the National Grid, who provide the energy in the UK, have said that, no, the problem was with Heathrow because they could have taken power from elsewhere and we were ready to do that. So there's this blame game here, because they know that Heathrow is going to try and pass the blame buck to the National Grid to get out of whatever the airlines are seeking from them. I mean, in all this, we have to keep a close eye, because if the airlines are going to be screwed over with this, they're then going to screw us over as passengers to compensate for that. So it is in our interest that the airlines are not screwed over with this. They didn't do anything wrong here. They were not involved at all. They were absolutely screwed by the circumstance. And whether or not that is the direct fault of the National Grid and Heathrow, or one or the other, is yet to be confirmed. But yeah, I understand their frustrations. And as you say, they were working through the night operationally so well, working through the night, that the next morning, you know, little Alex Macheras shows up at Terminal 5 and everything is completely smooth and beautiful and great. And I was thinking, these airlines did a great job, but I could not get it out of my head that the CEO went to bed. I just couldn't understand it.
I understand. And it's also crazy. Another example of Heathrow not caring enough, I would say, that how is Europe's busiest airport so reliant on one small power station? So if that goes out, everything collapses. It would be one thing if, okay, one terminal doesn't have power, but for everything just to shut down is so crazy. And just to mention here, we've had some
legitimate question, by the way. That's what you just said is a legitimate question. That is shaping the conversation in the UK right now. So you're spot on.
That's good. So, by the way, we've had a lot of questions about this. If you were impacted by the Heathrow shutdown, unfortunately, in this scenario, you are not entitled to UK 261 or EU 261 compensation because the event was outside the aircraft, the airline control. It was an extraordinary circumstance, as we call it. However, you are entitled to the regular, what is it called, duty of care, where you should get a hotel covered, meals, possible transportation. The airlines owe you for that, but they do not owe you any compensation, which is fair.
And that's crucial. The bit, you know, if you had to fork out on a hotel because you couldn't travel, you need to expense that to the airline along with any travel, your meals, things like that. Also, remember that the airline still had an obligation, no matter what, to get you from A to B, including rebooking you on another flight or also offering you a refund. So if any of you were caught up and just want to double check your rights, in addition to everything, of course, we've just outlined there and Dan has put so eloquently, do feel free to DM us as well. We're here to help you guys with that. To the dedicated listeners, if we can help you, we are ready to do so. Okay, let's move from London to Paris. I want to know how the La Première first class reveal event was, because you and I left Asia together. We left Singapore together and I stayed in Doha while you went on to this Air France new first class reveal event.
Yes, I did. It's been over a week now. Obviously, we didn't get a chance to discuss it last week, but it was obviously you were missed. It was not as fun have you there. But yeah, you guys might have seen that Air France has revealed its brand new La Première first class. And I'm very curious, what was the first thing you thought when you saw the photos and mock-ups of the seat?
You're asking me or the listeners?
You. No.
Oh, okay,
I mean,
I've heard
from the listeners. Okay. I just haven't heard from you.
I had two reactions. The first reaction was, isn't that the existing seat? That was my first reaction. The second reaction on seeing that it wasn't the existing seat and then seeing the clear differences, my second reaction was, why is the design not luxury? I know it doesn't fit with the current La Première, but to me it felt way too dentist chair arrangement because of the color palette. So I didn't like the dentist vibe.
I think it's obviously a matter of taste because some people seem to love it. They go, wow, this is so, so chic. But I think what you say is exactly right. Everybody in the room when the seat was revealed was thinking, what's the difference? So there was a clear...
Oh, shit.
When the wall turned around, there was just silence. You just heard some cameras clicking. No one was whispering to each other. No one was applauding. It was just sort of like, everyone's like, oh, so is the old seat going to move to the side to reveal the new one? And then the guy who actually is in charge of La Première, the head of La Première, we realized later as I was editing the video, he's the one who starts applauding so that then everyone else starts after the seat turned around. So yeah, it was a bit of an awkward moment.
But do you think
moment.
It's because that awkwardness just purely stemmed from the fact that on first glance, it looks so similar to the existing
exactly.
seat.
Yeah, everyone was confused. And then, of course, as you say, we realized as we got a tour that, okay, this is a big upgrade, a big evolution of the previous seat. Now we have a separate bed, which I know a lot of people who fly first class really value. So you have a bed and then you can move over to your chair and eat. There are just improvements here and there. And it's, of course, a fantastic seat. I think I'm always like a little bit tough on Air France La Première, which I think everyone should be tough and critical of Air France La Première because of the prices they charge. When you charge twice the amount of competitors, for example, the Middle East Airlines or Lufthansa and Swiss, who also have fantastic first-class products with quite comprehensive ground experiences, especially if you're originating in Frankfurt or Munich or Zurich, then, yeah, we expect a lot from Air France. But the conclusion, what I concluded in my video, is that Air France is doing what French luxury brands do. No one is saying that Hermès, for example, has better quality products than any other brand. It's just about the exclusivity. It's about the brand name. France is good at that, and that's what they're doing with La Première as well. They're trying to make it, you know, a step above the rest in terms of branding and marketing, but they're not out here saying it's the world's best first class. That's why I have a problem when people so unashamedly go, this is the world's best first class, there's nothing like it. And I'm like, yeah, of course, if you're paying twice as much as you are for other airlines, for example, $12,000 compared to $6,000, well, then if you're flying the other airline, you can add VIP services to your ticket, which gives you a better experience than La Première, and still pay less than you do for La Première. So people go,
it's a fortune, isn't it? I mean, you're buying the exclusivity of the fact that it is a fortune. And remember, we had the gentleman from Flying Blue on who kind of explained that also. So
yeah.
It's, And
the thing is this, that I got some very valid comments that I totally see the point of, that it is good in the market to have a first class that is just exclusive, because there's going to be people, celebrities and important business people, who want the crowd, the general public, to be as removed from them as possible for whatever reason. So that when a celebrity shows up in the La Première lounge, no one is going like me, sitting having breakfast next to Gigi Hadid and going to Oscar, oh my God, that's Gigi Hadid next to us.
Oh yes, you did, didn't you? You sat next to her at breakfast.
They do not want people like me in there who care about that. They want everyone to be on that level. That's what the celebrities want. So of course, by charging an absolute ridiculous fortune, those people will disappear. And by not being able to redeem points at all, those people disappear. So then you end up having a product that suits a very tiny niche portion of the market, while other airlines, I'm thinking Emirates, the world's biggest first class airline, their approach with first class is more that this is an occasional reward, an occasional treat for our frequent flyers. So I think there's not that many people who exclusively fly first class with Emirates, but it's more like, I normally fly business and now it's my birthday or now it's a special occasion and I'm going to splurge and enjoy first class. That's the kind of crowd.
Which in turn has made that way more accessible.
Exactly.
Than Air France, who are like, we don't care if anybody flies.
Yeah. And I think that's what's, I mean, obviously we're not the market for La Première. We're not those type of people, but it's lovely. Which of us has flown La Première?
Please. I'm joking. I am not the market for La Première at all. I have not flown La Première.
Yeah.
I have no plans to fly it. And you have flown it more than once. So
no, I've only flown it once. But
oh, was
you
it
know,
only
once?
Once was oh, enough. You know what I'm thinking of? I'm thinking of the video now. But the video now is the mock-up. Okay, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, I've sat in the new seat, which is pretty cool. But I think it's great for an airline to use first class as something that is attainable for their loyal customers as well. So that, you know, it's like using Emirates again as an example, someone who's a big fan of the airline, who's loyal to the airline, flying their first class is the epitome of flying Emirates. So although maybe you can't afford it on every occasion, the fact that it is relatively reachable for most of Emirates frequent flyers, I think is so valuable because it creates more of a reward and an incentive to stay loyal to the airline, because you know that you'll be able to have an even better experience on some special occasions when you want to, rather than business. You know, at Air France, after this, I basically view business class as their highest cabin for regular people, And then there's this semi-private jet at the very front that frequent flyers, Air France loyalists, all these people will never really be able to access. So it's like this entirely separate thing at the front. And I think that, you know, it's just, it's a bit sad.
The categorization of it, pardon me, is somewhere between first class and private, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's what they're hoping, not first class, that you know, people like you are teaching the rest of the world how to fly for almost nothing with the right points and everything. And yeah, that's interesting. I mean, the trip must have been exhausting because we had an exhausting on-air tour of Asia, and then you continued on to Paris. And we were like, and then you came back through Doha, and I was there because it was the opening of the D&E concourse. So the Hamad Airport expansion is now complete. There is now capacity to go to 65 million passengers with the new Delta and Echo concourses. The key headline being there are now loads more jet
contact gates.
Contact gates.
17 new contact gates, which
17
every
new contact gates.
New contact gate in Doha deserves a party because
one less bus.
Of course, on my departure from Doha, I still got a bus gate, but it's fine because
that's just to keep you humble.
Yeah, exactly.
I actually asked for that for you.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. But all in all, you know, I arrived from Copenhagen, and the fact I got a contact gate from Copenhagen, I was like, oh, this is a different era, because normally Copenhagen would be condemned to the furthest bus gate.
The area known as 600, which is on the other side of the runway.
Which takes about 600 years to reach by car or bus.
Yeah, it's called 600 because it takes 600 minutes to get to and from. Well,
yeah, so I love a new contact gate at Doha. Now, how many are there in total now? Because I count. I've sat there multiple times on Google Maps being like, 1, 2, 3, 4, to see how
psychopath.
Many contact gates you
psychopath.
Have.
Psychopath. I can't remember the exact number. I want to say...
My guess is 65. In my head,
I was gonna
somewhere
say,
around
I want
to
say 60, between 60... It's definitely early 60s now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it was 49 or so, something like that. And so I'm thinking, so I think
so
that
I've done,
right.
You know, I go around the region. I count how many contact gates are there in Doha.
Psychopath, you should not be allowed near airports.
How many are there in Dubai?
You should not be allowed near airports. That is absolute psychopath behavior.
This is important insider intel, okay, that no one else is gathering because no one else
is
sitting there.
How is it insider? You are on... Yeah, you're damn right nobody else is sitting, wasting their precious spare time looking at maps from above, counting the jet bridges. You're right. No one is doing that for good reason, because they're not psychopaths. Okay?
It's important information. Think about Singapore Changi. Oh my gosh, we haven't got to Singapore Changi.
Oh god,
Changi.
We haven't spoken. We cannot talk about Singapore tonight.
We need to talk about this next week.
Yeah, we'll save it for next. There's a few things I want to say for next week. We need to talk about Singapore Changi. Just thinking about it, I am starving thinking about it. Okay, so there's that. We need to think and thank the guy who commented in last week's episode, if you haven't seen it on YouTube, that said that your shirt looked like a Condor aircraft.
Yeah, I've heard that before. Okay.
So good.
Well, thanks for that. But by the way, we have like some very juicy stories from Changi that we need to bring up next week. But the point I was going to make about Changi is bus gates are one in a million in Changi. They have them, but they are rare. So that is why we need people like me out here counting the gates to know why is this the case? You know? Why is it that every time I land from Copenhagen, I'm treated like I'm being shuttled in from Siberia the first time I ever greet humanity? And I should be grateful I even get a bus gate. I should be grateful that I'm in Doha at all.
Honestly, you are so salty about the fact that most of your routes are not what the airlines perceive to be the premium routes, and you're just so bitter about it because you don't fly them from Paris, and you don't fly them from, you know, to listen, don't open this subject now because we'll be here all night, and it's so late here. but it is hilarious how deserving you feel, you know, your region is of only the best. And the moment you get a bus gate, which, by the way, London flights get bus gates as well, you are horrified. You're like, this is because it's Copenhagen. This is an insult to the Danes. And, you know,
it is crazy. It is a issue that the embassy to Denmark in Qatar, which I hear is basically a room in an apartment building. It's like a bathroom.
Don't you know? I don't know where you heard that. Whoa! Do not blend on air with off air. Okay, we've spoken about this before.
The little bathroom that is the Danish embassy needs to go to the state of Qatar and say, no more bus gates. We have had enough. There needs to be a protest. And now they need to stand up. So with that,
seriously,
let's go over to Q.
Who put 50 cents in you this morning? I am not sure. Right, a couple of Q&A and then we'll wrap, okay?
Yeah, let's do it. All right, Marcus asks us, hi guys, love the pod, question for you. How do airlines/seat manufacturers adapt premium seats for different wide bodies? For example, how does, say, Dan's favored Finnair business class differ on an A330 versus an A350? What is compromised on a narrower plane, in this case, the A330? What do we say?
Do you know what? Finnair's A330 and A350 product, the air lounge product, is always an example where I think they're so crazily consistent. I struggle to find the differences. Of all airlines, it's funny that he used that example because literally I made a point when I flew both the 330 and then the 350 connecting Helsinki. And I'm thinking, this is an example of almost copy-paste despite us being in very, very different airframes. Usually, forget Finnair for a minute, airlines have to make small adaptations. Usually something to do with the armrest size or the, you know, like the trim and finish, the small details that most passengers will not be aware of. And that's why if you fly an airline's business class, for example, rather than economy, because there's more happening in business class, and they operate both an Airbus fleet and a Boeing fleet, there will be those minor differences because structurally you're in a different aircraft. So that means different airframe, means different cabin walls, it means different overhead lockers, it means a different structure, and therefore the trim and finish is different.
And of course, this also assumes an airline has the same seats across their fleet, which we know that British Airways, for example, is reconfiguring their whole fleet with the same seat. United, I think United does a good job too with United Polaris, where you can't really tell the difference. Of course, you can tell the difference on a 767 because there's fewer seats per row, but actually sitting in the seat, you can't really tell that much of a difference. One thing I think about specifically with the A330, which is so narrow, but still gets a lot of regular business class seats, is surely, although I've never heard an airline say this, when they have a reverse herringbone, for example, which Cathay, Sri Lankan, several others have on an A330, the angle of the seat must be slightly less. Because if you think about a 777 with a reverse herringbone, it can be a bit more angled out into the aisle because the cabin is wider.
The cross-section is greater. Yeah. You've got a wider aisle as well and everything.
Exactly. So while on an A330, the angle compared to the wall of the fuselage must be actually slightly smaller because the seat can't jut into
and
the...
And don't forget also on an A330, there's much more narrowing than there is on, for example, like a 350 or a 777 or whatever. So, it's usually if the airline has the same product but operating on two different fleets, great question. But to sum up, usually it is the smaller trim and finish details that differ rather than the actual product itself. Yeah.
But just look at Lufthansa Allegris. It's the struggle bus of the century. Now it's on the 350, but just trying to get it on the 787.
Struggle bus.
Yeah. You've never heard this expression.
No. That's funny.
Okay, now you're going to know it. Struggle bus. But
I don't
know
if it's funny or if everything is funny when it's after midnight and I'm completely jet lagged from Asia. And
I'm
like,
just hilarious right now.
Sure.
So anyway, it is the struggle bus of the century considering different aircraft. So this is a good one. This is very relevant to what we've been discussing with British Airways today. Lex asks us, hi, Dan and Alex. I just wanted to say how much I enjoy the On Air podcast. You both make an incredible team. Thank you so much. I previously sent this question to Alex, but haven't received a response yet. So I thought I'd try reaching out here instead.
Oh my God, I'm sorry. Lex. I don't know. I usually see them. Sometimes my Instagram is bad at automatically putting it in like a hidden folder that never refreshes. And I'll find it, Lex. Don't worry.
We understand. So if you were to train a cabin crew member with a focus on hospitality, what would be your first tip or training session? I'm especially curious because I'll be starting my training as a KLM flight attendant soon. Looking forward to a chance to get your thoughts. I love this question because this is...
Wow, we could talk about this all the time. We both could, but yeah. But what's the first thing you would say? Let's keep it short because we don't want to give our list of 100 things, but what's the first thing we would say?
And the thing that makes service good on any airline is when you notice you have a flight attendant who personalizes things, who actually goes out of their way to, for example, greet you before takeoff or right after takeoff by coming to your seat and introducing themselves. So in this case, hi, my name is Lex. I'll be taking care of you today. Let me know if there's anything I can do.
That goes a long way.
Just doing that at the beginning of the flight goes such a long way. Also, depending on the airline, this is very different in economy. So if you're going to be a new flight attendant working in economy, you can't really be doing that. But this is specifically in business. You want to, something that you don't have to do, but that is absolutely amazing when a flight attendant does, is sort of just either bend down a bit or even crouch when you're talking to someone, because otherwise, a lot of the time you're towering over someone, which is not pleasant
for anyone. That's like, for example, when kids, when you go down to that level, it's because you're matching that, you know, in order to maintain a nice kind of harmonized conversation with both. And as you say, it's always uncomfortable when someone is towering over, just like the slightest flexibility to be able to show willingness to match level does instinctively kind of make the conversation better. I don't know, it just it's warmer for both, isn't it? Because someone's made the effort. It's the equivalent. It reminds me of how in most of Asia, you know, they're passing you the room key or the business card with two hands, and it's just this real sincerity rather than just the there you go, you know.
Yeah, that's obviously a cultural thing, but in economy, I think the one thing you can do is, first of all, if you're greeting people by the door, be very friendly, be very welcoming. You know, don't just stand there and ignore people. And then once you do the meal service, just a small thing like when you're serving juice or drinks, being like, what can I get you to drink, sir? Or what can I get you to drink, madam? Something tiny like that instead of drinks, you know, that makes a big difference as well. Although it's an additional effort, I think just trying to be, you know, premium in any way that you can by addressing people.
And it's not even just premium, is it? It's just really, really polite. I mean, look, we're not in the service industry, and I would refer to a gentleman next to me as, I'll give you an example. On the flight, there was a guy, and he opened the locker, and he looked plus 80 or so, and he was reaching for the locker, and I said, oh, 1 second, sir, I'll get that for you. But by instinct, I would say sir, because he's older. And I just think that's really polite. And so as you say, yes, you said, okay, it makes it feel premium, but it's also just really, really polite, which unfortunately I think is like a dying phase at the moment. It's like a dying trend because, oh, we all have to pander to this, you know, Gen Z/alpha thing of not talking to anyone and just you know, being awkward and weird. And no, we don't. We can actually maintain and hold nice, polite cultural values.
Yeah, goodness, what's going to happen when all people who work in service are Gen Z and Gen Alpha? But just one more thing I thought. Yeah. On most airlines, you can also see when someone is a frequent flyer, so someone has status. And just a small extra thing you can do in economy, I think, that really would blow me away is just try to remember their drink order. So if someone ordered a glass of red wine and they're a gold member, then coming back and being like, would you like another glass of red wine? Those types of things in economy go such a long way.
See, and would this be was so the wrong question to ask Dan, because Dan has 100 things on his list. Like, to any cabin crew out there would be super sensible to be writing this down, because if you end up with this gentleman on your flight, you know how to make him happy. It's just three things he said. He said, see, what's funny is it come down to his level, yet he's definitely taller than you. So that's that out the window, right? If he's standing. sir, okay, great. Or a nice polite interaction with maybe Mr. So-and-so or whatever. And then remember his drink order. And I'm going to give you an insider scoop now. He loves a lemon mint. I just traveled around Asia with him. It's quite easy. So something like that. And then apparently he's going to be really happy.
Well, there isn't lemon mint in question. Economy. So yeah, we could go on. I think we could teach this. We could have a whole guide, because I go through a list on every single flight. And, you know, ooh. I never submit complaints against cabin crew. But in my mind, I'm like, oh, they didn't do that. Oh, they, and then sometimes when
they didn't recognize that I'm a gold member and that this was my previous drink order. And then you're like,
no, I don't care about the status thing. I don't care, but it's other things. Interesting. Yeah. But when, it's very interesting. But then when they do something good, you know, when you can tell that they're fulfilling many things on the list of things that, you know, make them very impressive.
Yeah.
I'm like, I like that.
And then you write in, which we've spoken about before, the importance of writing into the airline. Anytime we have a good crew, we send our compliments straight in. It's so important.
I write in all the time. I just, you know, and I've started doing it now because I notice I procrastinate it. So actually, as soon as I get off the plane, I just do it immediately.
It's so much better to do it straight away. And it's fresh in your head. And then you don't like to say, oh, I've got to get around to it. Just do it. It takes a couple of minutes. That's a good idea. That's good.
So,
good advice. Okay. I'm going to say goodnight. It's super late here. And I'm going to wish you a very pleasant day. And good
Thank
to catch
you so
up.
Much.
And we have so much that we have to say for next week. So we'll note it down.
Next week, I feel, is like a bonus episode to this week. There better not be any big news, because I have many good Q&A questions from you guys as well. So,
me too. Yeah, likewise.
We will get to that when we see you all next week on air. Bye-bye.
See you later.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.